I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're joined by Pelham McDaniels, a former Chiefs player turned professor. He now works at Emory University in Atlanta, where he's the curator of African-American collections, but he'll be back in town this weekend for a symposium about the Pendergast era at the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Pelham. Long time no see.
Hi, Gina. How are you doing?
Good. You tend to study the intersection of sports, race, and American society, so it's not entirely surprising that your angle on the Pendergast era has to do with the social, political, and economic importance of black baseball to Kansas City's African-American community between 1919 and 1939. But it is a very specific topic. How did you happen to zero in on it? I mean, what got you interested in this specific time within this specific community?
Right. And I guess this is really one of those moments in history where you have this convergence of centennials and anniversaries that we all have to examine or at least take a look back at. You know, we're in the centennial of the Great Migration as well as the centennial of the First World War in Europe. And next year, 2017, will be in the centennial of the U.S. Participation, the beginning of the U.S. participating in the First World War in 1917. So part of this project is it's been ongoing. I mean, when I taught in Kansas City, I was really working with students in the community, trying to account for the impact of the First World War on African Americans in the Great Migration and the intended and unintended consequences of that war. So,
and when you talk about the Great Migration, can you explain what you're referencing there?
Well, again, this is a centennial. 1916 has been kind of identified as the year in which 100 years ago, African Americans en masse moved from the South to northern industrial cities like Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago, New York. And part of the work that I've been doing is understanding that that didn't just happen out of, I guess, what people would expect, that, you know, the brutality of the South with lynchings and, you know, the culture of sharecropping force black people to make a decision, you know, to continue to stay there and struggle and live, or to leave and flee and go to a better place. Well, that might be true because of the brutality. But with the First World War in Europe beginning in 1914, and a number of immigrants moving back or leaving the country to go defend their countries, and the U.S. participating in the war by providing war implements, the industries needed labor. And it just so happened that a concentration of labor or people available to be the labor, they were in the South, African Americans. And so the war created the impetus for what becomes known now historically as the Great Migration. So I've been looking at that historically to understand that, you know, while there may have been this shadow, you know, this wraith, if you will, overshadowing the South with this brutality that African Americans are experiencing, if the war had not occurred, if those locations in these northern industrial cities was that they were not vacated, that would allow for that population to be absorbed very easily. There would not be a reason to leave the South because, again, the pressures to stay were greater than the pressures to move.
How did baseball enter into the picture for you?
For me, baseball became, you know, part of the conversation when I started looking at the soldiers who were drafted to serve in the First World War, and those that, you know, went, a majority served in the service of supply regiments. You know, they were the ones responsible for unloading ships and building bridges and repairing battlefields and, you know, salvaging materials. And so what I found out was that these men, part of their activities, because a fit soldier is a good soldier, was to participate in athletics. These athletics were sponsored by the YMCA and the AEF, the American Expeditionary Forces. And a number of those baseball players on those regimental teams became some of the greatest Negro League baseball players that we have in recorded history. So as I'm examining the impact, the intended and unintended consequences of this war on African-American movement, migration, and opportunity, and studying the impact that the war is having on black men being drafted in particular roles, again, as the labor that would allow for the war, you know, to be supported through their work, the discovery of them playing the game of baseball in the fields in France, former farms, or on the bases where they were stationed in places like Brest or Saint-Nazaire or Bordeaux. To find that information for me was like, wait a minute, this is tied to something, a larger narrative that when we get back to the U.S. post-World War I, 1919, and you have in Kansas City the founding of the Negro National League in 1920, that this time period, this transition, is very important to the future of the game, but also the future of the communities.
How is it important to the future of the communities? I mean, the future of the game, you've spelled that out just very clearly, but why is that so important to the communities?
Well, I think one of the things that when you look very closely at this experience that these men are having, men in particular, women are also participating. African-American women are serving as war women workers, and they're coordinating here in the U.S., and a few women like Catherine Johnson and Addie Hunt go to France to serve as, mothers for some of these young men, just confidants for others. But the impact of serving as citizen soldiers, both abroad and at home, opens the eyes, opens a world up to these men that they had not been accustomed to. Not a majority, but those that were illiterate, those that did not know that the citizens voted for a president, those that did not realize if they were on the front lines that they could actually use a weapon and kill perceivably what was a white man who was a German. The kind of empowerment that they experience at having this experience would be transformative, not only for themselves, but when they came back home to wherever they ended up. Because, again, the idea is that the experience transformed them in such a way that they were not willing to go back to the way things were.
So do you think that has something to do with their role as baseball players when they came back to the United States in general, but to Kansas City in specific?
I don't think it was their role as baseball players. I think it was their newfound identities, and baseball was just an extension of the experiences that they shared in France, or even just being domestically located. That kind of organization, that kind of a opportunity to solidify this identity that one was a man, to wear a uniform in terms of a citizen soldier, it says something about who you are, who you want to be seen as, and who you yourself would like to become. And I think in terms of the uniform as a baseball player, could, and I think it does in some communities say the same thing. And I have something I want to read a little later that I've written before about this, but it's this series of, again, unintended consequences that provides kind of a foundation for this sense of self-discovery. And when you have this concentration of people who have seen the possibilities and they have now the skill sets and the will, they work extremely hard to construct that within their own communities. And I think we know that to be true in places like Chicago and in Kansas City with our 18th and Vine District. And, you had it here in Atlanta on Auburn Avenue. So, these types of scenarios, I think they ring true in so many ways.
Put the baseball piece of it and the social piece of it, that personal transformation, in context here in Kansas City, because this talk at the library is about the Pendergast era. And although the Pendergast story is one that many Kansas Cityans have heard told a number of times, and so is the story of Negro Leagues baseball in Kansas City, I don't know that I have heard those stories told together, even though we are talking about the same time period.
Right. I mean, so just think about the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, and we think about in terms of African-American culture, the introduction of anything of jazz music and this kind of high life. Besides Kansas City, you had places like Tulsa and you had places like Harlem and Chicago where the nightlife was really part of the culture, but it was not necessarily all of the culture. You had your literati. You had folks who were involved, of course, in the visual arts, and you have your schools. You have these vibrant communities that are thriving in their own particular way based on region, based on, you know, specifics to place. And so even though you have this, you know, the Pendergast era is also feeding into this, you know, the machine politics, the, you know, the aldermen, you have people like a Felix Payne, who was a power broker. You know, there are ways in which these types of communities are able to take advantage of their being marginalized from the larger society, but then at the same time are able to function quite clearly on their own. And so, you know, when it comes to baseball, in particular, in terms of the financing of baseball, Kansas City had a very special person in J.L. Wilkerson. And so here is someone who was dedicated to his team and to his players, who wasn't a numbers runner, but was a, you know, above the board businessman, who was competing with other teams with number runners, people who were maybe involved in you know, the shadier side of life, if not the particular communities. But at the end of the day, the people who came out to watch these games were coming to be entertained and participate in a communal activity.
So when you look back at the role that baseball is filling in this sort of complicated machine, how would you describe the characters and their stories? I mean, because you do get very personal with the stories and how you collect them. And I want to get into that more in a moment. But can you tell us some of the characters in baseball and how their stories are significant to you, and tell us something we might not already know about this time period?
Well, let me read something first to kind of set up the conversation further, because I think in terms of, you know, being a historian and a scholar and someone who is looking at, you know, looking between the lines, you know, really as it relates to looking at, you know, the evidence and juxtaposing it against, you know, itself and one another, pieces of a story, I think that interpretation also is very important. So let me read this. It says, baseball became a ritual that elevated not only the players, but raised the collective sense of community, humanity, and patriotism that the black masses felt whenever a black baseball team took to the playing field. Even though they were excluded from participating in America's pastime as full citizens, with all the privileges that being American entailed, those men who participated in the Negro League shouted clearly with every pitch, every swing, and every steal, "I am a man." So I read that because, again, we don't want to get outside the context of our segregated society where Jim Crow is the law of the land. And even though you have places like Kansas City where seemingly there is this, you know, an agreement between whites and blacks, those who are in power on both sides of the equation, to function because of the economic opportunities, we still live in a very segregated society where, you know, acts of defiance could be met with the lynchings or easily have people disappear. So I want to make sure that as we talk about this idea of baseball in community, whether or not it's Kansas City or Chicago or other places, that we understand that it's functioning not in a vacuum, but within the context of this larger conversation that is both being had with organizations like the NAACP, with the larger society and their protests on an almost weekly basis that a man has been lynched. I think that we have to be very clear about what the intent was for some of these men playing the game and how the community would have seen their performances as kind of informative of the future possibilities.
Yeah, this idea that they're asserting, "I am a man," when they step onto the diamond, I mean, can you flesh out the political significance of that? I mean, I hear echoes of, yeah, I am a man, and perhaps I am not just 3/5 of a man.
Right. So I guess when it comes down to thinking in terms of baseball, you know, we have this idea that it's this meritocracy. And when there was a ban on blacks in baseball in the 19th century, essentially that idea of baseball as American as apple pie, and, you know, anyone who plays the game essentially understands the values of what it means to be American. But to be excluded from the nation's pastime as a full citizen, being able to pursue through this democratic process of, you know, being able to show and demonstrate that you belong alongside a Russian Jew or a Polish immigrant or the son of an Irishman on a baseball field that's a level playing field, to be denied that access is to really to be denied your humanity in a way in this country. And so even though these men may have been denied that, they were not going to be denied that in their own communities. And so to have them play the game, and in one of the Ken Burns films, I'm going to pull from that, to play the game as if they invented it, was I think, very important to not only themselves playing the game, but their communities who saw them do these phenomenal things.
KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. When we return, you're welcome to call in with your own questions about black baseball in Kansas City's African-American community during the Pendergast era. You'll be talking with Pelham McDaniels, the former Chiefs player who is a scholar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Today, we're chatting with Pelham McDaniels about the social, economic, and political significance of black baseball for Kansas City's African-American community between 1919 and 1939. We've been hearing how the experience of serving abroad in the war had transformed a lot of men who became later the heroes of Negro Leagues baseball. And Pelham, your talk this weekend at the library is called Bringing the News. What is that phrase?
Well, bringing the news, again, borrowing from some of these Negro League players who have these fabulous oral histories, they talk about traveling, barnstorming across the Midwest and bringing the news. I mean, you have family members who have moved from the rural to the urban, and, you know, how was Johnny doing up there? And, you know, you bring the news that Johnny and his wife had a new baby, or, you know, how is such and such doing? And you would have this communal type of activity around not just the game, but the social interaction between the people. And, you know, when you come from somewhere, people know you, and if people know you, they know of you and the people you're from. And so this is a reciprocal type of scenario. So these men, along with Pullman porters, brought the news.
You mentioned just now oral histories, and I do understand that a lot of your research comes from unwritten, undocumented in some ways kinds of history. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I find fascinating, you know, as a historian, is, you know, oral histories have a controversial kind of presence in conversations. Sometimes it depends on who you're talking to, I guess, but the written word takes a precedence in some ways over the oral tradition, in that if it wasn't written down, then some people or some historians will, you know, won't think it's valid. So, but when you listen to people tell their stories, you can always corroborate the information they're telling with other sources. So in listening to some of the Negro League players that I had the fortunate opportunity to be around in Kansas City back in the early 90s, they told these fascinating stories. And, you know, the one I'll share that I think is probably one of the reasons why I stay so close to Kansas City in particular, but the baseball part, is the story that Buck O'Neill told me back in 1996. He told me on our way to one of the Legacy Award, one of the events, and he basically said, you know, he said, I knew your grandfather. And of course, I'd known him for maybe 6 years at the time. And I said, well, you're just now telling me this? And he said, well, you know, I'm older, and so you have to forgive me for that. But he said that when the Monarchs used to travel down to Muskogee, Oklahoma, where my grandfather lived and where my family migrated to from near Huntsville, Alabama, he said we would stay at your grandfather's hotel. We'd eat at this restaurant. And then after the games, he would take the fellas on the pool table for their money. And I was taken aback by it, because this is a story that I had never heard before. I'd never heard that my grandfather, you know, owned this hotel and restaurant. And
here's, you know, Buck O'Neill putting it together for you.
6 years after I've met him for the first time, on our way to the Legacy Awards to honor, you know, current players with, you know, former players, you know, trophies, awards named after former players anyway. So it was, for me, the connection between the social, the political, and the economic came together in this small story a 5-minute conversation that now, if, you know, what is this, 20 years later almost, you know, 20 years, yeah, to the almost to the date, that I have stayed connected. And so my interest in this, it is about community. It is about how these men and women and the children in the community recognize these men as significant in so many different ways, not just because they can hit a home run or they can throw a fastball, but for some of them, what they stood for and what they represented. You know, they were the ones who were well-traveled. They brought the news. You know, when Mr. O'Neill would talk, he'd talk about how sharp everyone dressed. All the other players you would see at these different Negro League events, they would say the same thing, you know, that everyone wore their finest. They
What's the significance
themselves.
Of that?
Yeah, it's a sense of pride. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, you're demonstrating through your clothing, through your you know, how you carry yourself, that you're going somewhere, that you've been somewhere, and that you can take other people with you, I think.
So
like, I think there was something.
Clothing in some ways is something that had a message too, that's not a written message.
It's style. You know, style says something. I think that how you wear your baseball cap, you know, I think there is something, the unwritten word, the text, the body as a text can speak loudly when carried in the right way, when draped with the right kind of clothes. And I think for these people, and again, I want to reiterate the fact that, you know, for Kansas City, you had more people coming in from the rural to the urban than migrating from the deep south to Kansas City. And so to be urban is to be hip, to be up on it. And so you also are able to demonstrate through a photograph, a photo postcard, that you are making it, you are arriving, even though you may not be. It gives a sense of hope.
Do I understand that part of another piece of sort of unwritten history that has been significant for you in your research is that how many people were naming their children after Negro Leagues players?
Well, just, yeah, some of these, you know, people like Joe Louis, Beryl the Boxer. I mean, you have, you know, stories. I mean, in Kansas City alone, you have Mr. Joe Louis Maddox, you know, who was named after Joe Louis Beryl. And so how that is carried forward, you know, I mean, we'd have to do some research on it in the communities to find out how many Satchels were born the same time that Satchel Paige was pitching, or how many Josh Gibsons were, how many kids were named Josh Gibson or Josh in Pittsburgh around the same time that he was, you know, doing what he's famous for doing, hitting home runs and being a great catcher.
Pelham, you just mentioned it's the name of someone who I believe is actually on the line, has just called in. So
yes.
let's go to Joe from Midtown. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A very good program. I'd just like to add that you're so right. I grew up in Southeast Missouri, and again, during the Great Migration, a number of people came to Kansas City, you know, for jobs, packing, whatever. And baseball was great there, and when they did get to Kansas City, it was a entertainment, an event that was very important in our lives, and they did dress up to go to baseball games. So that whole thing of how important baseball has been in the lives of African Americans, and especially his players that we made heroes, is very important.
And you are named, you are among the people who Pelham just mentioned as being named after a significant athlete.
Yes, the Brown Bomber, because we're talking about the time when many white people didn't consider black people men, and especially, you know, when it came to, you know, fighting white men or knocking down white men, and for Joe Louis to, you know, get that title was very important to my family. And there's a number of youngsters named after Joe Louis, and I'm sure there are others named after some of the great baseball players.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate your weighing in on this.
And thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Maddox.
When he talks about knocking white men down, I mean, there could be a mixed legacy from something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, and but again, one of the things that informs my work, Gina, is always understanding the context. Understanding, you know, if we read it through the lens of today, and we can imagine the kind of, you know, inflammatory response that would have happened, you know, in that time period, in different geographical locations, like in the Deep South. You know, we can imagine what would have happened to a black man there. In a more urban environment where the white man could be actually a German immigrant or someone who is of Irish descent, you know, the idea of race, it becomes almost gray in terms of, you know, geographical location and how one self-identifies. Oh, you know, and in terms of Joe Louis knocking down a white man, I think the one white man that we understand that was most significant was Max Schmeling. And so while he was a German and was identified as a Nazi in the 1938 fight, it didn't, you know, that wasn't the case in 1936. He was a white man that Americans were rooting for, and they didn't want Lewis to win. They wanted him to lose. But in 38, it changed. Now he was a German. Now he was a Nazi. Now he was the enemy. And Lewis represented everything that was American, everything that was a representative of democracy. And when he beat Schmeling, it was metaphorically seen as a victory of democracy over Nazism. And at the same time, it was the first time that he was called the American Joe Louis. He wasn't the Negro or the colored fighter. He was called the American. And so that resonated with the generation that Mr. Maddox represents, his parents and the children who were able to absorb that moment in time.
When we hear these stories about triumphs and progress and transformation, We are still, though, not talking about a social context where the odds are not stacked against all these guys. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, explain that a little further.
Well, I guess just thinking that we hear the heroic stories and the celebration,
yes,
and it still can't have been easy,
right,
for them.
Right, right. So, I mean, you know... And I'm glad you asked that question because when I worked in Kansas City, I always tried to explain that, you know, we romanticize this time period more than we really understand it. And that even though you have jazz and you have baseball and you have these wonderful kind of attributes of the community, it still functioned within the kind of, you know, Pendergast era where there was vice and there were narcotics and drugs and prostitution. And that was also a reality that people who were trying to become part of the country had to deal with and had to take advantage of, if we can call it that.
Well, Pelham McDaniels, this has been great. Thanks so much for joining us from Atlanta today.
Oh, I appreciate being back on the radio show.
Pelham will be speaking as part of a 2-day symposium at the library called Wide Open Town, Kansas City during the Pendergast Era. He's part of a panel on arts and culture this Saturday from 9 to 11. Our own Chuck Haddix will be on that panel as well. For information, head to the Kansas City Library's website, kclibrary.org. And with that, our time is up for today's show. You can listen back to both of this morning's discussions at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard, and sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, tune in for the story of food in Kansas City, beginning with some prehistoric ancestors who might have eaten bears. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.